Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Professor Alexander Nemirov for Outlandish Life, Peter Paul Rubens and the Baroque, exploring the dramatic art of the 17th century. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
Cirrhosis from Hep B, liver cancer from Hep B, and death from Hep B.
For more than three decades, it's been routine to give all newborns in the U.S. the hepatitis B vaccine. A CDC advisory committee could soon change that.
For Thursday, December 4th, this is All Things Considered.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The Department of Justice has instructed prison inspectors to stop using standards to protect LGBTQ people.
It's going to make people less safe. And when facilities are less safe for the most vulnerable and marginalized, they're less safe for everybody.
Also, for 2 days in a row, President Trump denigrated Somali people.
We'll hear from a reporter about the Somali population in Minnesota, the largest in the U.S.
And this week's word of the week is ideology.
Ideology has essentially become a form of name-calling. It's a way of sort of saying you have ridiculous or stupid beliefs.
Those stories after the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. U.S. military officials say they have conducted another strike on an alleged drug boat, this time in the eastern Pacific Ocean. A social media post from U.S. Southern Command states that the military conducted a, quote, lethal kinetic strike on a vessel in international waters operated by a designated terrorist organization. The Defense Department says four people were killed. Navy Admiral Frank Bradley told lawmakers on Capitol Hill today that there was no, quote, kill them all order from Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth during an attack on another alleged drug boat. Hegseth says he wasn't in the room on September 2nd when a second strike killed survivors of an initial attack on the vessel, but Bradley was. Rhode Island Democratic Senator Jack Reed, ranking member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, says the incident raises concerns about due process.
One of the problems we have here is if we don't insist upon strict observation of the rules of law, we can't expect our opponents to do it. And as a result, we're jeopardizing right. the lives of young men and women in our armed services. And that has to be foremost in our deliberations.
Lawmakers from both parties have questioned the legality of the administration's use of war powers against suspected drug smugglers. Congress hasn't authorized the use of military force. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled today that Texas can move forward with the congressional map that President Trump wanted and state lawmakers approved. As the Texas Newsroom's Blaise Gainey reports, it boosts Republicans' chances of keeping control of the House of Representatives.
The battle over which map Texans will use for the 2026 midterm elections had an impact that spread nationwide. Republicans came out victorious with this ruling. Their new map will likely give the GOP five additional seats. Texas House Democratic leader Gene Wu led a quorum break with lawmakers staying out of state to delay the map's passage. He says the move sends a message.
The Supreme Court allowing the maps to stand essentially means that what protections we have for voting, for communities, for people without as much power and without as much voice is over.
The ruling will also shake up which candidates decide to run in Texas. Austin Congressman Lloyd Doggett has said he won't run again if these maps were in place. He is yet to make that official. For NPR News, I'm Blaise Gainey in Austin.
A grand jury in Virginia has refused to indict New York Attorney General Letitia James for mortgage fraud after a judge dismissed another charge encouraged by President Trump. A judge halted that earlier prosecution of James and another longtime Trump critic, former FBI Director James Comey, after determining the U.S. attorney who presented the cases was illegally appointed. James said, quote, it is time for this unchecked weaponization of our justice system to stop. This is NPR News from Washington.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. Hundreds of striking teachers with their supporters rallied in Richmond this morning in front of the West Contra Costa Unified School District headquarters. The strike comes after months of unsuccessful negotiations. Teachers are demanding improved salaries and benefits, which they say will help reduce high turnover levels. Here's Union President Francisco Ortiz addressing the crowd.
We feel the harm when this district refuses to listen. And we refuse to stay silent while our students suffer instability year after year.
In a statement, district officials said they're set to return to the bargaining table with the union this afternoon. This morning's false earthquake warning was likely triggered by what USGS officials are describing as ground movement out in the field. KQED's senior science editor Kevin Stark reports they say it wasn't an earthquake, but they're not sure yet what caused the shaking.
The U.S. Geological Survey says four seismic stations in Nevada detected the ground movement, and that's what triggered the alert that went off on phones across the Bay Area. In the past, the early warning system has alerted more people than necessary. Operations lead Robert DeGroup says that wasn't the case this time.
But this is the very first time where we've had sort of what I call a through-and-through false alert delivery because of something that may have happened out somewhere out in the field.
The USGS is analyzing data from its stations and considering launching a field investigation. I'm Kevin Stark, KQED News.
And I'm Natalia Navarro.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for NPR comes from Imaginable Futures, envisioning a future where learning sparks opportunity and thriving belongs to everyone. Learn more at imaginablefutures.com and from the listeners of KQED. And support for KQED comes from the San Francisco Symphony, where listeners can join the symphony to ring in the holidays with festive concerts throughout December. Learn more about their holiday programs at sfsymphony.org/holiday.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The Trump administration's efforts to overhaul how kids get vaccinated against infectious diseases devolved into confusion today. A powerful federal committee fell into disarray as it appeared poised to recommend a big change in how children are vaccinated against hepatitis B. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein is here with more. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Okay, so start. What is this powerful federal committee?
Yeah, it's the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. And this committee's recommendations have a huge impact on how kids get vaccinated. Today, the committee was moving towards ending a long-standing recommendation that all babies get vaccinated against hepatitis B at birth. The shot helps protect them from developing chronic liver disease and dying from liver cancer and liver failure later in life. But after hours of presentations and debate, the committee unexpectedly hit pause. It's the third time the committee essentially kicked this can down the road. Something similar happened in September when the committee met.
The third time. Interesting. Okay, so tell me a little bit more what exactly they were supposed to vote on today.
Sure. The committee was supposed to vote on whether to replace the universal recommendation that babies get vaccinated against hepatitis B at birth with a recommendation that babies only get vaccinated when their mothers test positive for the virus or if their infection status is unknown. And they only routinely vaccinated them in those situations. Mm-hmm. Instead of the usual practice of hearing presentations from CDC scientists, the committee was briefed by outside experts. A presentation about hepatitis B, for example, was given by a climate scientist working as a CDC contractor. But committee members in favor of the changes argued there wasn't enough evidence to support the vaccination. Here's Retses Levy, an MIT management professor.
As a father and as a scientist, I don't know how we have the courage, based on such slim evidence, to come to parents and tell them that that's okay to give to your zero-day baby.
Some other committee members and major medical groups, however, strongly disputed that. They say the changes would be a huge mistake.
A huge mistake. Why?
Well, they say there's plenty of evidence that the hepatitis B vaccine is very safe and highly effective. In fact, routine hepatitis B vaccination at birth has been standard practice for decades and has caused liver infections to plummet. Here's what Dr. Sandra Feihoffer from the American Medical Association told the committee today.
When I was a medical student, I rotated through a hepatitis ward, and those were the sickest patients I had ever seen in my life. I have treated patients that have liver disease from Hep B, cirrhosis from Hep B, liver cancer from Hep B, and death from Hep B. We have a duty to protect these little babies.
Nevertheless, the committee seemed inclined to make the change.
Okay, so I'm still trying to put my finger on why exactly they postponed the vote today.
Yeah. So just as the committee was about to vote, the chairman suddenly announced that the advisors would vote on three questions instead of two. But he didn't have a slide that they could read with the new language, and that led to some obvious consternation. Here's Dr. Joseph Hiblin, a psychiatrist on the panel.
We're trying to evaluate a moving target, and we don't even have a slide explicitly describing what questions we're supposed to answer.
So they did vote, but to put off any new recommendation until tomorrow.
They voted to kick it to tomorrow. What happens tomorrow?
Exactly. Well, the committee is scheduled to vote again Friday, maybe in the morning, and then the advisors will turn their scrutiny to the rest of the childhood vaccine schedule. And for decades, that schedule has protected babies against more than a dozen dangerous infectious diseases, and that includes measles, tetanus, and polio.
NPR Health Correspondent Rob Stein, thank you.
You bet, Mary Elise.
For the second day in a row, President Trump denigrated Somali people yesterday.
Look at their nation. Look how bad their nation is. It's not even a nation. It's just people walking around killing each other.
Speaking from the White House, he also called for the removal of Somali people, especially from Minnesota, where the Somali community numbers around 80,000 people.
The Somalians should be out of here. They've destroyed our country. And all they do is complain, complain, complain.
Ahead of an expected increase of federal immigration enforcement in Minneapolis-St. Paul targeting the Somali community, local officials spoke up in support.
When people are arrested by federal immigration agents, they're going to get the wrong people. They're going to screw it up so badly that they're not just violating habeas corpus, but they are taking away the rights of American citizens.
Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey said in the Somali language, "We love you. We stand with you. We aren't backing down." Let's hear now from the Twin Cities. Caitlin Vu is a reporter from Sahan Journal. That's a news outlet focused on the immigrant population in Minnesota. Caitlin, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Caitlin, if you could just start by telling us, what do we know so far about federal immigration enforcement in the Twin Cities this week?
We started hearing tips that about 100 federal agents were flown into Minnesota Monday night, and then enforcement started right away. There was like an uptick of what immigration advocate groups were seeing, focused on targeting the Somali community. There were reports from Brooklyn Park to St. Cloud to St. Paul and Minneapolis.
In your most recent story, it noted that only about 4,200 of the more than 80,000 Somalis living in Minnesota are not U.S. citizens, and many of those 4,200 have permanent residency green cards. Is it clear at this point what federal immigration authorities are targeting here?
Well, we saw President Donald Trump revoked temporary protected status for Somali Americans across the country. And that's about 700. That's a small number of people, but in Minnesota, we have the largest Somali population here. So we're thinking that a lot of the folks that have TPS reside in Minnesota, and I think a smaller fraction than that are undocumented here.
We've heard from state and local government officials, including the mayors of the Twin Cities, and they've expressed a lot of verbal support. But I'm curious, what have you been hearing from leaders within the Somali community about how they're feeling and experiencing this now?
Yeah, so yesterday I spent a lot of time in these hubs where there's a lot of Somali Minnesotans in City Riverside and in Carmel Mall. And a lot of the residents I was talking to, they're kind of feeling like they're being used as a scapegoat, that it's used as a distraction, sort of like a political tactic. That's what they're describing, what's happening.
Now, part of what's prompted the latest round of criticism from President Trump is the sprawling fraud scheme in which dozens of people in Minnesota have been either charged or convicted of federal crimes related to stealing pandemic relief funding, and many of them are Somali people. What has been the response to all of that within the community there?
Well, a lot of folks that I've talked to who are Somali residents and Somali elected officials are saying that the FBI investigation on that fraud that you're talking about, that is a small number of folks in the Somali community. There's 80,000 that are here. So they're just saying that this small number of folks don't reflect the entire community.
We've mentioned that more than 80,000 Somalis now live in Minnesota. Historically, why does the state house so many people, such a big chunk of the Somali diaspora?
You know, Minnesota has been a state that has always been very accepting of refugees. Not only is there a big Somali population here, there's also a big Hmong population here. Somalia, there was a civil war that happened. Their national government collapsed, and so that led to a lot of them fleeing to Minnesota. There's also Minnesota's a state that has a lot of opportunities, a lot of great education and training for jobs. So they've really helped support Minnesota's growth and businesses, increasing the population and helping a lot of other immigrant communities that are also here.
Caitlin Vu reports on immigration for the Minnesota news outlet Sahan Journal. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Now to a big change happening inside America's prisons and jails, a change that advocates say could put the trans community in increased danger. According to an internal memo obtained by NPR, the U.S. Department of Justice has told prison inspectors to stop evaluating detention centers on standards meant to protect this vulnerable community. NPR's Jacqueline Diaz has more.
Sexual violence in prison has been a problem for decades. In 2003, a little-known law called the Prison Rape Elimination Act, also called PREA, was passed to address it.
People really didn't know what to do. Addressing the issue of sexual abuse in detention was not standard practice at all.
It isn't perfect, but it helped. That's according to Linda McFarlane. She's a longtime PREA advocate. Auditors must visit prisons and jails to ensure they follow PREA standards. But this new memo tells those auditors to disregard some important requirements, including whether transgender people are housed based on their gender identity, and whether reports of sexual assault were motivated by gender identity bias. Here's McFarlane again.
It's going to make people less safe. And when facilities are less safe for the most vulnerable and marginalized, they're less safe for everybody.
McFarlane is the executive director of Just Detention International, which works to end sexual abuse in prisons. The memo says the DOJ intends to rewrite these standards to align with the Trump administration position that the U.S. recognizes only two sexes, male and female. For now, the PREA standards technically remain in place. It's unclear how the DOJ plans to enforce this memo, and officials didn't respond to NPR's request for comment. Brenda Smith is an American University law professor and former member of the National Prison Rape Elimination Commission. She says this memo ignores the well-documented risks facing the LGBTQ community in prison.
The data is there. The data is clear. And you can't ignore it, even though it seems that that is their intent.
A 2015 survey from the criminal justice group Black and Pink found that LGBTQ prisoners were around 6 times more likely to be sexually assaulted than the general prison population. This is based on survey responses from more than 1,100 prisoners. The policy change is the latest in a series of Trump-era moves affecting transgender people, including bans on transgender troops from serving openly and limiting gender-affirming care for minors. Jacqueline Diaz, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Traffic's just awful on the Dublin Grade this afternoon, or this evening now. With the latest, here's Julie Deppich.
And the motorcycle crash happened a couple of hours ago, eastbound 580 near Rao Ranch. The two left lanes remain blocked. We've got a major backup still to the 238 interchange. It's a crash on the peninsula, San Mateo, on southbound 101 before Highway 92. Second lane for the left is blocked, possibly also the right lane. And up in the North Bay on south 101 before central San Rafael, 4-vehicle wreck, 2 left lanes are blocked there. It's a slow crawl back to St. Vincent Drive. Julie Deppich for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that. And support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers, announcing the Season of New Traditions event going on now at local Kia dealers, offering a selection of SUVs, sedans, and hybrids. More info at Kia.com.
It's been a heavy year in the news, but at NPR, we always find time for a break.
Earlier this week, we reported on octopuses. Octopi?
A chance to dish with a friend.
Everything comes back to Love Island.
Love Island, everything. Or a quick nosh.
I mean, warm and potatoey on the inside, and then the hint of onion. Oh.
Give back to the station that brings you joy and wonder, along with the news, by making your gift today.
Give at kqed.org/donate.
Coming up this evening at 6:30 on Political Breakdown, we consider the aesthetic style of the Trump administration. Candace Grady from Vox talks about the so-called MAGA look and the presentation of femininity during President Trump's second term. That's on Political Breakdown coming up tonight at 6:30. Support for NPR comes from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. From Focus Features, presenting Hamnet, a story of love and loss that inspired the creation of Shakespeare's Hamlet, directed by Chloe Zhao, now playing in select theaters everywhere December 5th, and from the listeners of KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highland Sacramento.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The Supreme Court has delivered a win for Republicans in the gerrymandering fight for Congress. The court is allowing Texas to use a new map that could help Republicans keep control of the House of Representatives. NPR's Hansi Lo Wong has been tracking this redistricting battle. He joins us to break down the court's ruling. Hey, Hansi.
Hey, Mary Louise.
So start with the very basic question. What is this Supreme Court decision mean for Texas?
This means next year's congressional election in Texas will be using a new map of voting districts that could help Republicans pick up 5 more House seats. And on the national level, this ruling boosts Republicans' chances of holding on to their slim majority in the U.S. House. So this is a major development, this unprecedented gerrymandering fight that President Trump launched by pushing Texas and other Republican-led states to redraw their House districts before the midterms.
Okay, and this was an unsigned order, so what do we actually know about how the Supreme Court came to this decision?
Well, we know that a majority on the court took issue with a lower court ruling that had blocked this congressional map that Texas passed back in August. This lower court found that map to likely be unconstitutional, but the Supreme Court says the lower court, quote, failed to honor the presumption of legislative good faith. And the high court also criticized the lower court for, quote, improperly inserting itself into the primary campaign because it released its ruling in the middle of the candidate filing period in Texas. I should note the 3 liberal justices on the Supreme Court agreed with the lower court's ruling.
Okay, so as usual, a lower court ruling is at the center of this. Tell us about that decision.
It came out of a 9-day hearing before a panel of 3 federal judges last month as part of these lawsuits against the Texas map. And a majority of that panel concluded that the groups challenging the map are likely to prove in a trial that the Texas map discriminates against voters based on race. The judge who wrote the majority opinion was nominated by President Trump, and the opinion cited a letter the Justice Department wrote to Texas officials and multiple public statements by key Republican state lawmakers involved in developing the Texas map, and it all suggests Texas lawmakers passed this map to get rid of existing districts where Black and Latino voters together make up the majority. But Texas has claimed that lawmakers were not motivated by race and were driven to draw new districts that are more likely to elect Republicans.
Okay, so you've just laid out a lot for us to untangle there. The bottom line, it sounds like, is the Supreme Court has now issued a decision, and they've decided which map Texas is going to use for next year's election. It just broaden this out a little bit. What about other states? Where does this gerrymandering fight stand?
A lot going on. The gerrymandering in Texas, of course, sparked a new congressional map in California that could help Democrats pick up 5 more House seats. Voters approved that map last month in a special election. Now it's caught up in a federal lawsuit, so I'm watching to see what happens after a court hearing this month. There are also ongoing lawsuits against the new Republican-friendly map passed in Missouri, which is also facing a contested referendum effort. And there may be more Republican-friendly maps coming out of Indiana and Florida. And I'm keeping an eye on the Supreme Court again, because there may be an upcoming ruling in a voting rights case about Louisiana's congressional map. And depending on when the Supreme Court rules and what it rules and decides in that case, there may be another wave of congressional gerrymandering, especially in the South.
NPR's Hansi Lo Wong, thank you.
You're welcome.
The Afghan refugee accused of carrying out the deadly attack on National Guard soldiers last week came from Bellingham. It's a small city in northern Washington state. Now, people in the community fear Afghans living there could be targeted as part of the Trump administration's crackdown on Afghan migrants. NPR's Brian Mann reports.
Any Pacific Northwest day, Jeremy Darrow stands outside a coffee shop in Bellingham. He's an organizer with a volunteer group called Racial Unity Now that supports the city's small group of Afghan refugees.
I was a Christian, you know, in the Christian ministry. The Afghan community ended up falling to us a lot of the times simply because there was nowhere else to turn.
Bellingham is a city of about 100,000 people. A cluster of Afghan families numbering in the dozens began arriving here in 2021 after the fall of Kabul. U.S. allies were evacuated from Afghanistan, vetted, and offered a fresh start in America. Doro says getting them resettled in this northern coastal city has been tough.
Small community agencies like ours have had to learn on the go.
Then came last week's violence when an Afghan national from Bellingham drove to Washington, D.C., and allegedly opened fire on two National Guard soldiers. In the wake of the attack, President Trump froze all Afghan refugee claims and ordered a reexamination of Afghans living in the U.S. legally. Doro says Afghan families here in Bellingham are in shock.
Overwhelming fear. They're constantly looking out the window. Are they coming for me tonight? You know, am I next?
Because of that fear, NPR's efforts to speak directly with Afghan families here were unsuccessful. The local mosque sent NPR a statement asking for privacy and distancing their faith community from Rahmanullah Lakhanwal. He's the 29-year-old Afghan who worked with the CIA in Afghanistan, who is now accused of killing one guard member and seriously wounding another. He's pleaded not guilty. NPR was able to reach an Afghan organizer based in Washington State, Muhammad, who's helping refugees resettle.
All they are doing is stressing, they are worrying, and they are living in a desperate situation. I receive a lot of messages from them.
Muhammad, a former interpreter for the U.S. military, agreed to be interviewed only if NPR identified him by his first name alone. He fears losing his own legal status in the U.S. and fears retribution against family members still living in Afghanistan. Muhammad says many Afghan refugees here in Washington state were already struggling to find housing and jobs while learning a new language and acclimating to a different culture.
They need help with a lot of the basic needs, which is stressing them a lot.
Jeremy Darrow says despite years of work and sacrifice as U.S. allies, many Afghan refugees who came to Bellingham were left to sink or swim.
And we can either abandon them or we can help them. So we need to help them.
Some in Bellingham who work closely with Afghan refugees say they're even more vulnerable now. Gabriel Harrison is an immigration attorney who represents many of the community's Afghan families.
Universally, the feeling was fear. What will happen to me? What will happen to my family? What will happen to our cases? Are we going to be detained?
In statements after the shooting in D.C., Trump has questioned whether Afghan refugees contribute in positive ways to American life. But Harrison says most people in Bellingham do see these families as an important part of the community.
They've all been humble, kind, educated people. You know, and asking them what do they want people to know about their situation was, we're not violent. We're not a violent people.
That view is shared by Skylar Anderson. He and his family are neighbors to the Lakhanwal family in the apartment building where federal agents carried out a raid last week.
I mean, their kids were always outside playing soccer and whatnot in the stairwells. Never any yelling, screaming, or nothing from their apartment.
Anderson says if Lakhanwal himself is guilty of shooting the two guard members, he should be punished. Asked about Trump's crackdown on all Afghans in Bellingham and around the country, Anderson shakes his head and says, I don't think we should deport everybody. Brian Mann, NPR News, Bellingham, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Stay tuned for a political breakdown after your traffic update starting in the North Bay. Here's Julie Depesch.
And big trouble here. Southbound 101 before Central San Rafael. Four vehicle pileup takes away the two left lanes. Slam back to Miller Creek Road. Got a three vehicle crash Walnut Creek on eastbound 24 just before the 680 interchange. You'll see that in the middle lane. And really nothing's changed coming out the Dublin Grade eastbound 580 at Rao Ranch Road. That motorcycle crash still blocking the two left lanes. Heavy back up to 238. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa at Yosemite. Support for KQED comes from Block Construction, service-minded builders striving to enhance California communities, building schools, housing, and more. Block Construction, helping build futures since 1970. Info at block.com, BLACH.com, and from visitorscoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at visitorscoverage.com.
Hey everyone, from KQED in San Francisco, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. Today on The Breakdown, what does femininity look like in the Republican MAGA world? Every presidential administration has its own aesthetic style, but none in recent memory is as pronounced as the look that many of President Donald Trump's female allies and cabinet members have embraced in recent years.
Derisively called Mar-a-Lago face, the look popular in MAGA circles includes flowing long hair, two perfect teeth, heavy makeup, and often plastic surgery and fillers. What does this MAGA aesthetic tell us about the president, his policies, and how does it fit in with the traditional role many conservatives say women should play? Here to talk through this all is Constance Grady. She is a senior correspondent on the culture team at Vox. Constance, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I mean, you've been writing about these questions, and as Scott noted, all administrations have aesthetics. You know, George W. had his cowboy hats and boots. The Obamas brought in a sort of very modern sensibility. I wonder, though, if you feel like how women in the MAGA Trump world are presenting themselves stands out in some way in terms of ubiquitousness, consistency. Is it different?
I think there's certainly a big difference between what the Trump administration is doing and what previous presidential administrations have doing to begin with, just in terms of how pervasive it is. You know, the Obamas brought in that more youthful, kind of accessible, cool. It was a really big deal that Michelle Obama didn't wear pantyhose and she shopped at J. Crew the way like normal middle class people did. But his cabinet wasn't really dressing the same way his family was dressing. That was not a conversation at all. In the Trump administration, major cabinet officials holding very prestigious jobs are really dressing to Trump's preferred aesthetic in a way that is both jarring and also not surprising at all. One thing that we know about Trump is that he really thinks that having the right appearance is important. He likes to say that his favorite appointees are right out of central casting. They're supposed to look the part to him. And when he says a woman looks the part, what he usually means is that she kind of looks like a Fox News host. There's a lot of Botox, hair extensions, very caked on, specific makeup placement, and a kind of artificiality that he really gets a kick out of.
Well, and we should say it's not just people close to the president like Lara Trump from his family and administration officials like DHS Secretary Kristi Noem is also MAGA supporters. I mean, you see it in the crowds at his rallies and so on. What is that about? Is it just wanting to, you know, be part of that
club?
You know, that club?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's certainly, you're very right to say that it's not just his close allies. Plastic surgeons have been reporting more requests for Mar-a-Lago face from their clients, as they're calling it these days. I think that we can see a few things there. One is that people tend to be drawn to the aesthetics of power, no matter who is holding that aesthetic. There's a reason that American fashion can be changed around by politicians, like famously JFK not wearing hats, getting rid of hats for men. And I think we can see some of that in the desire some people are showing to just like look like the Trump folk, look like the MAGA folk, look like they belong in these hallowed echelons, like they have the money to buy this kind of expensive surgery and show it off. But it also speaks to a sense of what a woman's role is supposed to be, right? She's supposed to be someone who is very obviously performing beauty. And she's supposed to be doing it in a way that is deferential to the preferences of the most powerful man around her, which in this case is the president.
Yeah. Before we go any further, I want to acknowledge, like, this is a thorny topic, right? To think
Absolutely.
About, to write about, to talk about women's looks. I wonder how you thought about that in your reporting and writing. And also, like, what's the argument? What's the reason that this is not just about aesthetics? It's about something more.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, and I appreciate you bringing it up. Absolutely, any woman has the right to do whatever she wants to do with her body and her face and the way she dresses and presents herself. I think that's without question the case. However, the way that people present themselves when they are political figures tells us a lot. It's one of the ways that they are communicating with the public. This is something that we keep in mind when we talk about men's aesthetics a lot. Vanessa Friedman at the New York Times has written extensively about how she covers men's fashion in a way that doesn't get talked about that much. But she considers their presentation choices to be a way that they're telling us what they want us to think of them.
Mm-hmm.
Those articles, she said, have tended to kind of float under the radar because people get much more excited when they get a chance to talk about women's bodies. We live in a culture that loves to denigrate women for any appearance choices they make. And I think that's something to keep in mind and be aware of when we're having these conversations. At the same time, those choices are not meaningless. They are telling us what these people think a woman should be. They're telling us what they think women should aspire to be.
Mm.
And that's something that I think is really worth decoding, especially under an administration that has eroded women's rights as effectively as this one has.
You said that some women now just go to their plastic surgeon and say they want, you know, a MAGA face or a MAGA look. What does that mean? You kind of alluded to it earlier, but like fill in the details a little bit.
I think the defining feature of Mar-a-Lago look is that it's not supposed to be subtle. It's not supposed to be the kind of thing where you kind of pass it off to your friends as like, oh, I just got really good rest.
Right. I got a facial.
Yeah. No, it's supposed to be something that looks clearly surgically amplified. Your face looks different than it used to. The cheekbones get really, really high. The forehead gets very still and frozen. The hair gets very long. Usually there's some highlighting at the very least, or it just goes entirely blonde. Teeth get very white. Everything is amplified and exaggerated. It's a little bit of an 80s aesthetic, which makes sense for Trump's preferences because that is when he kind of crystallized his taste in popular culture.
And it's so fascinating because plastic surgery has gotten better, so you don't need to always show it. But that is certainly, I think in other circles, even outside of MAGA, you think about like it's also a sign of wealth and success.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder like if you feel like Trump himself has really like pushed this look. You know, you mentioned that he likes to talk about central casting. Obviously, he was a reality TV star, Mr. Universe pageant producer. He's, you know, gilds everything in gold. But like, is this a look that he specifically likes?
Yeah. Now, I don't know that Trump is out there telling his aides to go out and get themselves surgery to look a specific way. I have no reason to believe that's the case. But he acts very approving when he finds that someone has remolded their aesthetic in a way that he likes. When he's talked about Kristi Noem, he said things like, oh, you're not allowed to say that she's beautiful, so I won't say that she's beautiful. that kind of thing. He gets excited when people look the way he thinks they're supposed to look.
What about Melania, his wife, the first lady? Because it seems like she's maybe not full MAGA, but I mean, she's got her own sort of style. She's very stylish. How does she fit in with all this?
Melania Trump is a really interesting example here. So she obviously had a career as a fashion model well before she met Trump. And she's been straightforward about the fact that she considers maintaining her looks sort of part of their arrangement. I think she said in one interview, do you think he would like me if I weren't beautiful? That's as she understands it, what she's bringing to the table. She's very unusual for a first lady in that she tends not to dress in American designers. She goes pretty high fashion. lots of European designers on her. She is certainly doing a more overt kind of glamour than someone like, for instance, Jill Biden or Michelle Obama, who were both kind of performing a down-to-earth American middle class kind of a look. What Melania is doing is a lot less accessible. This is probably epitomized most famously in Trump's first term when she wore a jacket that said, "I don't really care, do you?" Kind of wearing her opinions on her sleeve, or rather the back of her jacket.
Yeah. Yeah, it almost strikes me that, like, maybe she's the sort of ideal that is hard to get to within the MAGA world, because she was a model, right? She does have this more effortless beauty. And it is interesting that in some ways she, Ivanka, are like the least sort of Mar-a-Lago-esque on all of this. I wonder, like, is this a callback in some way? You mentioned the 80s, but even beyond that too, like a more feminized sort of traditional era in the U.S.? Like, is this aesthetic speaking to sort of a policy or worldview that you think Trump wants everyone to embrace?
That's an interesting question. Plastic surgery as we know it hasn't necessarily been around that long. I mean, it was,
I guess, more the hyper-feminization,
yeah,
right? It's,
yeah,
the idea, certainly, that you have to present so female.
I think that the ideal that we're seeing embodied here is a little bit old Hollywood, this sort of attempt to create this larger-than-life femininity that will look huge and beautiful on a movie screen. But the movie screen is the small screen now. It's the tiny screens of TikTok where Trump stuff performs really, really well. It's the screens of Fox News and Newsmax. I think that the sort of hyper femininity of it does speak to a desire to return to what MAGA folks would consider more traditional gender roles.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of discussion of this idea that everyone's all confused now and the kids are all becoming trans at school and what have you. And I think that there's a desire to make the lines between gender very clear and bright and specific. And certainly leaning into this particular feminine ideal can help do that.
Yeah. And I should say, I think that's a topic we are going to revisit at another point, the masculine ideals. All right. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue talking to Vox culture writer Constance Grady. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED News.
Support for KQED comes from Landmark College, offering academic executive function and social coaching support for neurodivergent individuals at the Bay Area Success Center. Learn more at landmark.edu/successcenter. And from KQED's Bay Curious podcast, a show answering listener questions about the Bay Area, features fun trivia questions in each episode. Listen and enter to win cool prizes at kqed.org/baycurious, sponsored by Sierra Nevada Brewing Company. Good evening. It's 6:42. I'm Michelle Hennigan. Julie Depesh will be back with your traffic update after Political Breakdown. And then at 7 o'clock on Fresh Air, the guest tonight is George Clooney. He became famous at 34, late enough, he says, that he learned how to live before he learned how to be famous. The character in his new film, J. Kelly, wasn't so lucky. That's on Fresh Air, coming up at 7 here on KQED News.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos, here with Scott Schaefer. Today we're speaking with Constance Grady. She is a senior correspondent on the culture team at Vox.
I want to talk about Kristi Noem. She was the governor of South Dakota, not known as a sort of fashion capital of the country. She's had clearly a lot of work done, and she's the Homeland Security Secretary, which in many ways, you know, it's responsible for keeping the country safe, not the image you would expect, not a typical image. What do you think, how would you describe her look, first of all, and how does it fit in with, you know, what the administration is trying to project?
Yeah, Kristi Noem has been one of the more visible members of this administration and has made her own appearance kind of at the center of her messaging, kind of infamously during the beginning of the very visible deportation raids that ICE has been performing. She appeared at CECOT, the prison where these detainees were being held without trial, kind of posed in front of essentially a cage full of shirtless captive men.
First of all, do not come to our country illegally. You will be removed and you will be prosecuted. But know that this facility is one of the tools in our toolkit that we will use if you commit crimes against the American people.
So she comes across very no-nonsense in the audio clip. I don't think you would recognize, if you didn't already know, that she's saying this in full glam, with like her long ringlety hair cascading down her front and lots of bold makeup and kind of a sporty baseball cap on. It's a really, really striking look. I think part of what she's doing is trying to make it okay that she's taking on this traditionally masculine role of like the sheriff. She's kind of the stern sheriff in a Western is what she's performing. But she's doing it in a very girly way. I think that's part of what is appealing to about her to people in the Trump administration, that she's able to do these very masculine things in a very feminine aesthetic, which sort of softens everything up to them.
And is that also like a way for women to access power under this president? Because it's like almost like she's not threatening if she's presenting in this hyper feminine way.
Yeah. It's a way of taking power while looking as though you're not the kind of woman who would do a thing like that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the press secretary, Caroline Leavitt. Yeah, she's the most visible. She's on camera all the time. She's taken a little bit of a different aesthetic approach. How would you describe her look behind the podium there?
There's this great Washington Post quote about Caroline Leavitt. This was written in January of this year. It says, Trump's newest press secretary is radiant, blonde, and apple-cheeked as if one of Leonardo da Vinci's Madonnas had been styled for a Fox News hit.
Back to the Fox News aesthetic, yeah.
Listen, Roger Ailes really set an aesthetic for the whole political movement. She portrays herself very soft, very winning. She's quite young. She's the youngest press secretary there's ever been. She's a new mom. She has this lovely blonde hair and these sort of sweet round cheeks. And she presents herself in this very Americana, maternal, disappointed mom kind of way from the White House podium.
I mean, I wonder though, like, you talked about her being a new mom. I know she came back to work 4 days after giving birth. There's been reporting that she's in like this tiny office, which is not usually where the White House press secretary is. A man got that larger office.
And
I wonder like how you see those seem like big sacrifices, particularly coming back to work after 4 days. But is the aesthetic part of like the sacrifice that's expected in this world?
Yeah, this is something that I've been thinking about a lot. The story of Caroline Leavitt coming back to work is really, really central to her image. She talks about it all the time, every profile she ever does, that she was 4 days postpartum the day that Trump was shot at during his campaign, and she immediately, like, took her baby in her arms and set off to meet him. I think that the idea of being the mom who sacrifices to the greater good is a really, really potent symbol. The mom who, you know, would like to stay home with her kids and work the way good women should, quote unquote, but is instead just so committed to the movement that she's going to make the sacrifice of her womanhood and her motherhood for the leader that she loves so much. I think that idea is also kind of encoded in the extreme aesthetic that Trump more or less demands from the people who work with him. The idea is that you're sacrificing in order to look and behave the way he wants you to look and behave. You're going through the pain and the money and the inconvenience of plastic surgery to embody this aesthetic that he prefers.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED News. I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos, and we're talking with Vox culture writer Constance Grady. I'm wondering, how does this look that we've been talking about fit with the trad wife, the traditional wife, conservative ideal of a woman? Are they supposed to be soft and feminine, or are they supposed to be ruthless and sort of owning the libs? I mean, is there a conflict there?
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that Rebecca Traister has talked about a lot, this impossible bind that conservative women find themselves in. I think Kristi Noem is a good example of someone who has really struggled to make her way through this contradictory image. She released a memoir last year in which she spoke about shooting her family's pet dog. And this was such a big controversy that she went from being a Trump VP frontrunner to getting downgraded to Department of Homeland Security. That's still an important cabinet position, but she was very close to being VP and positioning herself as potentially the 2028 Republican candidate. And the fact that she did something as just mean and cold as killing a dog.
And kind of bragged about it in her book.
Yeah. And you have to think that she must have thought it would play as like the tough hot lady sheriff image, right? That she's been playing with as secretary, that we've seen over the past year. But it just it didn't come off right. People were really, really upset about it. And I think she's struggled to find the right balance for herself ever since.
Well, and I think, too, what you see is sometimes this argument that by making these sacrifices, it's actually empowering to women. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of, I think your writing and others have, you know, referenced Phyllis Schlafly, the pioneer in the Republican women's movement who really fought against the Equal Rights Amendment, basically saying it's going to take away the rights of women in a marriage and make them, you know, force them out of this wife role that they want. Like, or do you see that framing within this kind of conversation about the aesthetic?
Yeah, I mean, any time that you criticize the structures that are incentivizing women to do things against their best interest, then you get the criticism back that actually women really want to be held within these structures, and it's not fair of you to say that they shouldn't have to, because they're choosing it and it's their free choice. I would say in response that as a feminist, my concern is not really whether individual women think it's fun and great to be complicit in these structures. Because, you know, for some people it will be, and, it's, if you can pull off, a power grab like we're seeing these women try to pull off, then it's probably kind of fun when it works for you.
Yeah.
But if it is not helpful to the larger project of making all women's lives better, then I kind of struggle to see it as worthy of feminist acclaim.
You know, it's so different, too, from the kind of image we've seen in, you know, Democratic administrations or in Democratic circles. Hillary Clinton, Kamala Harris, you know, in their dark pantsuits, kind of muted makeup. Michelle Obama.
Trying not to be too feminine, right? I think
I'm not going to be like Tammy Wynette standing behind my man,
yeah.
You know, baking cookies. And she got in big trouble for that. You know,
She had to make cookies.
She had to make cookies. Oh, my gosh. Michelle Obama also has spoken about that and, you know, her conscious decision not to wear her hair in natural curls or locks. So, you know, MAGA, by contrast, seems to be purposefully doing this sort of to make it almost an exclusionary kind of look, like to make it different from certainly from Democrats, but also from like what many have thought about as feminine in our culture recently.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. You can't do the MAGA thing by accident or without enough money to pay for it. It is a very exclusionary aesthetic by its nature.
Yeah. What do you think? Are there like racial politics involved here? Like he brought up Michelle Obama, and I thought that that was really fascinating. Her talking about that in her new book, that she was like, the country wasn't ready for a black family in the White House looking too black, essentially, right? Mm-hmm. And like, it just makes me wonder if there is, like sort of racial politics involved in this ideal that we're talking about.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I mean, I don't think Trump considers most people of color to be out of central casting or have the look that he prefers in the people that he's appointing to positions of power. I think when it comes to the MAGA women, they are very much amplifying their whiteness in sort of the same ways that they're amplifying and almost burlesquing their femininity. It's about the blondeness, right? It's about the European features. It's about this kind of ideal of like a Marilyn Monroe. It's the big brass band Americana look. And that is a very white archetype.
Well, in that regard, I'm wondering if you've seen any evolution in the look or style of the second lady, Usha Vance, Vice President Vance's wife.
That's a good question. Usha Vance has kept a fairly low profile for much of this time. But she's also in a different position than a lot of the women we've been talking about because she's an academic, and the aesthetic coding in that world is a lot less glamorous. You're kind of taken less seriously as an academic if you have, you know, noticeable plastic surgery, if you wear a lot of makeup even all that often. So I think the world that she is operating within, her incentives are very, very different than the world that a Caroline Leavitt is operating in.
I think we should mention too that, I mean, there has been some blowback in MAGA world. Megyn Kelly kind of famously went after Christine Noem, but also none of these folks are talking openly about procedures they've had done. In fact, I think some people have sort of denied it. So like, what does that tell you? That at the same time as this look is really based on what we talked about, like the obviousness, the affluence it takes to get these kind of surgeries, but then we still don't talk about the surgery.
Yeah, that is really interesting. And it's kind of a repetition of this dynamic that is pretty familiar, I think, to a lot of women, where you're supposed to work really hard to look good, but you're never supposed to talk about it, right? Like, you're not supposed to admit to being on a diet or an exercise regimen. You can think of that 2000 celebrity profile trope in magazines where the cool girl would always eat a cheeseburger during the interview to prove that she wasn't starving herself to look the way that she did. This is a trope that's in mainstream pop culture got discussed a lot over the last decade, and I think has kind of lost its force in a lot of places, but we can kind of still see it operating in MAGA world. You're supposed to look a certain way and act as though it's possible to look that way naturally.
Yeah. You know, we don't want to talk about male masculinity in this particular show, but, you know, Trump used to own the Miss Universe pageant, you know, for many years. I mean, to what extent do you think this is kind of, you know, an extension of that?
That's a really, really good connection, I think. Trump, oh, Lord, Miss Universe. One of the things that Miss Universe has been in trouble for recently as a franchise, its CEO was caught on camera saying that they would arrange things so that it would look like fat people or trans people or people of color could win the competition, but they would never actually win. And I think that kind of speaks to the way that both that kind of franchise and the MAGA universe understand how we deal with body diversity and body positivity. You can maybe say, oh, it's fine to be whatever size and whatever race and whatever gender identity you want, but like, actually, we all know, right, is the idea in the MAGA world that really only hot blondes with European features count as beautiful. And I think that's sort of living out in the women Trump's elevating.
Yeah. In the very short time we have left, I wonder if you think that this aesthetic sort of helps soften a policy agenda that is not soft, that has been pretty brutal and different in some ways.
Yeah, this is something that Trump has wielded pretty effectively, I think. During his first term, there was a phenomenon known as the Ivanka voter, where women who didn't necessarily agree with Trump would say, well, you know, but he raised Ivanka, so I think things must be okay there. And I think we can see him sort of playing for a similar effect with the women that he has made very visible now that Ivanka has put herself
as exited
more
stage left. Yes. All right.
Taken herself out.
We have to leave it there. Constance Grady is a culture writer at Vox. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's going to be a wrap for Thursday, December 4th. Political Breakdown's a production of KQED.
Our engineer today is Jim Bennett. Our producer is Izzy Bloom. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. We'll see you next time.
George Clooney is coming up on Fresh Air tonight. The program starts after your Bay Area traffic update, including that big crash on the Dublin Grade. Here's Julie Depesh.
And been dealing with that major injury wreck involving a motorcycle since about 4:30 eastbound 580 at Rao Ranch Road. Those two left lanes remain blocked. Major backup there to the 238 interchange. A trouble continues on the peninsula, San Mateo on South 101 before Highway 92. Wreck been blocking the three right lanes, jammed back to Broadway. Now we've got a stall on the Golden Gate Bridge southbound at the North Tower. You'll see that car in the right lane. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Shen Yun Performing Arts. Support for KQED comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy works to create a healthy, resilient, secure world for all on the web at theschmidt.org. The Weather Service has issued a coastal flood advisory for a series of king tides through Sunday. Fog will blanket the inland valleys tonight in Northern California.